I asked this wonderful young lady to talk on the show because there's a lot of anger and we need some resolution conflict. We have people with different ideas, and I think people being social distancing, staying at home, and feeling very restrictive are causing tempers to flare. So hopefully she can give us some tips, some guidelines, and some calming resolution conflict tips to help us not act rash. It's never a good thing when a small town is at each other's throats, because that's all we've got. Okay, Dr. Monroe, please introduce yourself and all those letters behind your name and tell the Gallup, New Mexico, and the Four Corners area all about yourself.
Well, good morning, everybody, and I'm absolutely thrilled to be here. You have an amazing platform and perspective, and I'm very honored. So a little bit about my background. So I'm an LPC, those are those letters, and that's licensed professional counselor. So that's the license under which I'm allowed to administer psychological counseling to people. I also have a PhD, which is in international psychology, and the focus that I studied in that program was trauma services. So some of my experience includes work in places such as Peru, Ghana, West Africa, Afghanistan and the Middle East and the Caribbean. A lot of my work in those countries centered around humanitarian efforts, and I got quite a bit of experience in sociopolitical conflict and the marginalization of different groups of people. Mm. Then stateside, I've done work at the Pentagon for several years on the crisis action team. Mm-hmm. And then I did a lot of collaboration work with the University of Pennsylvania, and those are the gurus in the field of resilience and positive psychology. So that's a little bit about my background and my letters.
I thank you for, you know, this is community radio, so we're not compensating you, but I know you're very, very busy. But I appreciate, because we do have Doctors Without Borders down here, and we have a lot of people in our area who are trying to help. Mm-hmm. But the tension is high, and I'm sure you're feeling it in Texas where you're at. But in this little community, that I'm looking for people to give people tools, because you're the professional, on how to deal with feeling like their rights are being restricted or their lives are being restricted. And frustration without being destructive. Yep. What are some healthy ways they can express themselves?
Well, first of all, there's a big missing piece a lot of times, and you and I discussed it a little bit when we spoke earlier and visited and got to know each other, but that's, you know, in our U.S. macro culture, we are so marketed to about the quick fix and the magic pill, and when all the COVID-19 pandemic things started going on, you know, I've worked with Ebola and I've worked in humanitarian areas, and I was like, I kind of saw the writing on the wall of how it would go. Mm-hmm. I try to be optimistic, and I am, but a couple things we need to understand so that we know what to do. And so one has to pretty much understand the stressor itself in order to address it. So all the times in my practice, people will come in and they'll want a solution to XYZ problem. And I'm like, well, we need to understand why XYZ is a problem for you. So that deeper understanding of what physically in the brain and in the spirit leads to the sensation of anger or anxiety, the understanding of that helps you to figure out what to do about it. So within each person, whether it's you as an individual or if you're looking at a community or if you look at the larger picture, what you first have to do is kind of look at what actually has to be going inside a human's brain, what has to be going on to register anxiety and anger. I'm supposed to be writing a book on this right now, actually, for the American Counseling Association. I've only done the outline. So look at anxiousness. So think about the last time, and if everybody could do a little exercise for themselves, think about the last time you felt anxiousness. And sometimes a word that we use simultaneously for anxiousness or anxiety is stress or disturbance or some kind of inner turmoil. So there are basically five things that your brain and or spirit has to register for you to feel the anxiousness. And one is the easy one, and we see this with the COVID-19, a threat to one's life, safety, or integrity of self or others. So if you register that, let's say you're walking down a dark alley, you hear footsteps quickening behind you, you better feel anxiety, right? Mm-hmm. So God or evolution gave us that sensation. Another one is social rejection. So this is something I'm seeing going on with a lot of people right now. When they come up against someone with an opinion different than theirs, they're automatically, their brain's kind of going straight to a noticing of social rejection. So the hackles come up a little bit. But since we don't understand that sensation very much in our macroculture, we go for what I call the low-hanging fruit, and we kind of skip over and we kind of look at the other person and we're like, you're causing this disturbance in me, when that's not the case. Another registry is pain, physical or emotional. Emotional pain registers this pretty much the same in the brain as physical. So, you know, if you stub your toe, you don't go, oh, that hurt. It's not a depressed feeling, is it? No. You go, ow, and there's a slight energetic. So that's anxiety. Anxiety is an up feeling or sensation, an ouch. Like if you hear someone talking about you or saying something bad about you, it hurts. And you kind of feel like a stab in the chest or a physical sensation. That's anxiety. The good one that I love, anxiety registry, is joy or excitement. Imagine being at an amazing concert. You kind of feel that thrill inside. So we want more of that anxiousness. And then the last one is conflict or dishonesty within self. So if maybe you know that you're an intelligent person, but you're being told that you're stupid and your ideas are horrible, that doesn't feel good. Mm-hmm. That feels anxious. So that's anxiety. And then so anger is along that. Anger is an energetic. And so anger has, like, you can picture a range in your head of anything from slightly annoyed or irritated is at one end of the range, and rage and uncontrollable rage to the extent of violence or outward physicality, that would be that end of anger. So anything along that range. So kind of think of the last time that you felt that energetic but in a negative connotation, so an annoyance or a disturbance, and think about what of those five registries that may have been. And if the feeling of the anxiousness you can notice is anger, like that feels very different, right, mm-hmm. than fear. So if it's anger, that is a registry of trespass, which like violation, and there's a theme of lack of control along that. So almost always, and usually it does feel categorized, if someone's angry, they have somehow registered a loss of power or control. And the function of that anger is to energize, to hopefully change that. And most things are from an instinct perspective of survival and social cohesion, believe it or not. So hopefully that helps just to kind of register. Then kind of register acknowledge and assess what has caused this anger or this fear or this anxiety within me to register. Where did that sensation come from? Mm-hmm. And then you can figure out what to do with it. So I want to quit talking for a minute and let you interject. I feel like I've said a lot.
No, you're the expert, because this needs to be said. Maybe one of the frustrations people have is they don't know how to organize their mm-hmm. feelings or identify.
Exactly.
They always say, know thyself, but what if you don't know yourself? What if you don't have impulse control? Or you know, mm-hmm. this is 2020. We should be able to identify what our characteristics mm-hmm. are, what our triggers mm-hmm. are, what our shortfalls are. But mm-hmm. a lot of us, and I'll include myself, we have shortcomings when it comes to ourselves. We can sit and look at other people and say, well, you do this and you do that. But subconsciously, right. we know we have the same shortcomings, but we don't give flesh to it. It's in the back of our head. We might acknowledge it mm-hmm. in the dire straits, but in the average days, we're not one of those people, in other words.
Yeah.
And so it helps if a person can organize, because it's not as, I mean, mm-hmm. if you feel that you have shortcomings or a character defect, then you feel lesser than. But if you organize mm-hmm. your feelings in a more manageable way, number one, it becomes manageable and you feel more human, because you can say, okay, this is part of anxiety other than anger. I feel threatened because mm-hmm. maybe as a professional, healthcare professional, someone's not taking mm-hmm. my words, or I'm used to my life being a certain way. And now people who are attacking my certain way of life, my comfort zone is being threatened. Mm-hmm. Either Maybe I'm one of those people that only feels comfortable with people with the same beliefs or ideas or skin color or our financial status. But now things are normalizing because I'm doing the same things everybody else and I don't know what to do with myself. Yeah. But we don't want to admit that these are petty or these are not valid because then it makes you feel like, well, I'm an adult, but now I feel out of control. It's a catch-22 because no one is perfect. I always say, unless you got a burning bush or you're walking on water or you see a handwriting on the wall, we all are human. We all make mistakes. But people don't want to admit that. They want to blame somebody else or something else and then fix it. So it does help that you acknowledge threat, social rejection, pain, joy, and conflict. And also pain, I've known that pain is like a cultural thing because some people were learned that certain pain is notable when others are not. I have a friend who's Doctors Without Borders, and he said in certain places in Africa, people do have surgery done without anesthetic because they learned that that type of pain is not the one you cry about. They still feel it, but they don't react to it. But then you have other people that get a hangnail and they cry for days. So
learned behavior.
Yeah. And so what's going on with the people in our country, is it a learned behavior? Because like we mentioned before, in the 1940s, when, you know, we had rations, people were going without eggs and metal and milk and cheese and basic things that they were used to. And they were happy to give up those things to fight for a common cause for the war effort.
Yeah.
But now we have the descendants of these people who just don't want to go out without a haircut or getting their hair dyed or the convenience of going to your store or working out. They want.
So there are reasons for that. So that's a lot of my doctoral studies, and I've been fascinating watching it go down. And I have lots of friends in other countries, and I compare notes with them. So here are some things in our current, and I say macro culture because always there are individuals and different peoples and groups. But in the U.S., some things that we have working against us as far as the factor of cohesion and social, respect for others. But some of the things that we have going for us that feed the problem, we have the luxury of comfort and safety to a degree. Now, granted, we do have more gun violence than almost any country in the entire world. So safety, but we feel that we have safety, even though by numbers and statistics, debatable. But we have that. So it's very hard for you to sit inside your home and feel very comforted. And by that, I mean the world standards. We're not in a tiny, non-air controlled, you know, no heat, no cold. You know, we're very comfortable. We have, you know, food supplies, and we have things that a lot of other people around the world don't have ever.
Basic needs.
They're met. So we're very comfortable and luxurious in that way. So it makes it very difficult to really get us to a point where we feel vulnerable. So if you can kind of think back to right at first when this came down, there was a little bit more cohesion and a little bit more of uncertainty. And I did see people, you know, reaching out that I hadn't heard from years gone by and all that. Well, what happens is initially a conflict or some pending threat occurs. So let's look back at like 9/11. If you remember 9/11, everybody had a flag hanging from their window and everybody loved each other. Race didn't matter as much as it did before. And you saw all that. We all were together and pride. Everyone took the flag down out of their window on some given day.
Yeah.
So it's the same type of phenomenon where right at first, everybody's like, oh my gosh, let's come together, call your old best friend. And then it kind of wanes, and that's human dynamic. So right at first, our human nature is to come together in times of uncertainty and pending threat. But this pending threat isn't a physical enemy. And also we have working against us our very agenda-ridden media. So my advice to all of my clients has been, and all of them, every single one of them who did this, reduced their anxiousness. They stopped their consumption of mainstream media.
Yes.
And they instead turned their focus to sources that were fact-based. You got to be very careful about that. And they were not listening to MSNBC or Fox. So they didn't get an extremist, one-sided view that, you know, I will just, for psychological curiosity, glance over to these sources, and they're basically calling other people idiots for not thinking the way that they do. Well, if you're consuming that every day, the way that the brain functions is you're absorbing that, and that becomes your thought process as well. So my advice to everyone, if we truly want to come together, is reduce drastically, like limit your time, have like, okay, from 10 to 11 a.m., I'm going to listen to this news station, but then that's it. Mm-hmm. Same thing with social media. Just very, very vastly limit that. So there are sources. There's a wonderful physician in my hometown of Corsicana, Texas. He put an amazing Facebook site together, and he's pretty, he's advanced in age, so he had someone else do it for him, but he dictated what to say on it. And it was fact-based. He gave specific information to so that anyone in the area or the world, but in the area, would know what's going on in that community. It's a small rural community, and their numbers have been amazing. And a lot of it was because of the fact-based information that he disseminated as far as how many ventilators are in that hospital, their daily numbers, their death tolls. So if we had fact-based places to go, there would be less of the polarization. There was, I don't know, did you ever do old school research in like the dungeons of libraries with microfiche?
Yes, yes, I did.
Okay. Way back in the day, when I was an undergrad psychology student, I was in one of those such areas. I was looking at microfiche, and I ran across, I've not been able to find it since. So I challenge anyone listening, it's a fascinating, look this up. But it was a letter, like snail mail dialogue, between Einstein and Freud, Sigmund Freud, discussing war and conflict and why man engages in such, specifically in situations where you don't literally have to, like you do have food, you do have territory, you're not like the animal, you know. It's very interesting, and they tossed around ideas, but I remember one that stuck out to me that it's just reoccurred to me a lot over the years and during this is when human, but they were saying men because that was what they talked about back then, but when man lacks control of his own personal freedom and action, he becomes angry, and he strikes out at what he is able to. So it's kind of the kick the dog phenomena. The man comes home from work and he's had a horrible day at work.
Yeah.
Well, he can't kick the boss, can he? No. So he kicks the dog. That's a human dynamic, and unless we control that very instinctual, primitive, kind of a pathetic action, then it's gonna consume. Mm-hmm. So we first of all have to be aware, and that's a big problem in the United States is our lack of self-awareness because of automated thought. So if someone's not conscious and aware of their actions, they're just going to be reacting, and that means psychotropic medications can interfere with one's natural bodily reaction to things, as well as sleep deprivation, and that means under 8 hours for most individuals. Lots of different things interact with our ability to think with our prefrontal cortex that God and evolution has given us. So we have to engage that.
Our education system, is that something we should consider? Because if people aren't learning how to deal with frustrations in a healthy way, other than kicking the dog or finding someone else smaller to bully or drinking or overeating or passing the
buck
on, what can we do? Do you have to pass it on to the education system to tell people etiquette?
Yeah, I would love it, because it's not going to go on in every household, and there are many reasons and barriers as to why. But we know so much now with neuroscience. You always see on the quote unquote happy scales of world countries, you always see the Scandinavians, right? And specifically in some of those countries, they have, they call it different things, but it's along the lines of empathetic thought. But they have that as part of their core curriculum for all children in their public school systems, their first year of school through their teenage years, and it's a course. They teach that because they understand its cornerstone in a society that functions well. So we could definitely do that. I think, however, with our different systems and the pressures as far as finances and testing and all of that, it would be really hard for schools to prioritize that. But I would love to see it happen.
Yeah. Unfortunately, you know, like you said, money-wise, I'm sure there are some private schools. Montessori probably has something.
Yeah.
Getting in touch. But I guess our human nature and our animal brain supersedes anything else. Do you think if a family, like if a parent who has those parenting skills and they produce children and those children produce children, there's no way a child from that line is going to learn anything other than what's in that family. And so
But
if they surround themselves with people who they're comfortable with, for instance, and I'm not trying to make you feel uncomfortable. My son came back from med school and he had said that he was shocked because there's a child that he used to eat lunch with, and him and his friends would eat lunch with. I don't know if they liked him or whatever, but they said that the reason why he was gone is he was bragging that he was in lockup with his uncle. And my son was lying. I said, no one would brag about being detained by the police. And he says, no, he was very proud of it. I mean, when I was growing up, you didn't want even your parents to know that you skipped school or you were late or you didn't do that. And the fact that this child was bragging that, you know, but that's the environment they're from. And
exactly.
You don't want to insult anybody. I just don't see how there will be a common bridge between that child understanding that what that happened to him is not normal, or in his life maybe it is, but that's not healthy without him or his parents or his parents' parents being insulted. So even now when I suggested that, I said I was going to do this show so people can get some help, I had one friend reach out and say, who am I to think that people need my help? They can figure things out on their own. And it's like, I didn't mean to say that my little community radio show is going to solve the world's problems. But it's like, I'm an ambiguous person out there just trying to deliver some information. And they got insulted by me just suggesting that there's some tools out there to help us deal with today.
And what problems. That was is that individual felt anxiousness, and she did exactly what I was mentioning earlier. She felt anxiousness. She's not able
from
to
a stranger,
what
pretty
it
much
is.
Stranger. How can you feel anxious by somebody you don't really know?
I know.
That's
because you brushed up against something. You said it earlier too, but this is exactly what's going on. Someone felt uncomfortable. Now, whatever you said sparked discomfort in herself. You probably hit on something. You know, she's like, what? I have self-responsibility. Whatever it was that registered made her feel a slight anxiousness. Now, it's an energetic. It's for good. But we have been made to think that anxiousness is negative and bad, and we shouldn't feel it, and we should feel peaceful and la-di-da-di happy all the time, which isn't true. Mm-hmm. And then she went for the low-hanging fruit, which was you, because you were the one associated with her feeling anxiousness, and we can't process her. A wonderful book it's actually a parenting book, but I've had some of my clients read it to understand where they came from and what has caused their internal dialogue is the Danish book on parenting. You can look that up. But what it does is it talks about, I believe she's a psychologist or a physician, I'm not quite sure. She moved to Denmark with her Dane husband, and she just noticed how different the dialogue was among parents to their children. Well, that becomes their inner dialogue. Our immediate family becomes our inner dialogue. Here's a problem in the U.S. People place their children in front of a television while they're watching it. So the baby is in front of CSI or Third Rock from the Sun or whatever. So the babies aren't absorbing actual interpersonal home dialogue sometimes at all.
Or video
and
games.
That's happening. Yes, and it's a horrible issue. And pornography is huge. Children are consuming, unfortunately, pornography starting at ages 8, 9, 10, because they have their tablets and they're seeing things. So all these dynamics that are going on, and our government does not control that very much, and it's for profit, whereas in other countries they do because they understand the harm that does to children's brains. Mm-hmm. So we have more of an economic focus governmentally, and then culturally here in the United States, it's more economically focused and individualistic. That is a hallmark of our macroculture since World War II era. Mm-hmm. So you hear people, I've taught in the classroom at college level, and we talk about, it's a developmental psych class, and every time I hear the kids, they're adults, sorry, they're freshmen, but the focus on, well, I need my child to be independent, and there is a vast difference between human disconnect and independence. Mm-hmm. Children sleep with their parents until they're, whenever they want to, in most other countries in the world. We think that will make them not independent. And there are many independent and strong people around the world, but we have this idea of independence, and it comes at the cost of actual disconnect, where we don't care if our family member lives in another state, and we don't really miss them. That's just how it goes. In some of the countries that I research, Petter, specifically, all the Peruvian immigrants in my study mentioned how horribly they missed their family and how most of them had moved their family here. And they would have jokes like, if you're on a sinking ship and you have one life preserver left, do you give it to your kid or to your mother? And here they say, well, your kid. And then he said in Peru, they would always answer, well, your mother, because you can never have another mother. But here, people aren't that close. So it's so interesting. So a lot of it is cultural, just differences. And again, I'm not, we're focusing on, what's at the root of some of our conflict right now, and that's why I'm not saying that only our culture is bad. That's just what we're focusing on right now. Mm-hmm. But those are the things I'm seeing are at the root when I'm hearing people conflict with each other. We are not right now a macroculture of tolerance and embracing of differences. That's not our U.S. culture so much recently, in recent decades, versus some others where, we have to listen to others and have a curiosity, and that's just not our makeup. We are more about kind of being tough and being strong, and that's what's kind of championed macroculturally. We're different. We're strong, we're independent, but that doesn't help in times like this in some ways.
So is it a nostalgia, mm-hmm. looking back and seeing how we did come together at times, like with World War One and World War Two, or that's just a rose-colored way of looking at? Do you really think people did that, or that's just the propaganda that shows us old news clips that we were
I believe it's true, because I talked to my grandparents extensively. But again, that was a very different time, and our grandparents came from very different cultural roots. Some of them were only first and second generation, mm-hmm. and they did not live in a life of, luxury, mm-hmm. relative luxury that we have. And it was a different time. And also, there was an actual physical enemy. So again, I kind of compare that to remember how everybody felt immediately after 9/11. Mm-hmm. This is different. Mm-hmm. My other friends in other countries, they are asking me, like, are people really doing this? And why don't you spoiled Americans just stay inside for a couple of months?
Yeah, I've heard that too. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm like, well, first, and there are different factors for that. It's not that we're necessarily spoiled. It's that it hasn't hit most of our communities. Exactly. But that's how we're portrayed worldwide with media. Yeah. And so I say that, we're about 50-50. I was like, not everybody's doing that. And we haven't been overrun in some, in my area of Texas, we have not, our hospitals haven't been stressed, and we haven't been overrun, and most of us don't know anyone directly who's been contracted. So it's very different because we're more spaced out, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we haven't directly felt it. It's very hard to feel a threat when it's not directly affecting you and you're very comfortable.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and that's what we are. So it's just difficult, I think, for people to understand until they're directly seeing it.
Mm-hmm. I had, I'm respiratory, and I'm a polysomnography, and I had an OT who used to yell at this mm-hmm. doctor, because he says, I don't care if you're an orthopedic surgeon, if you've never broken a leg, you can't really empathize with your patient if you've never gone through the pain yourself, because the doctor would push the PT and OT to have a patient do a certain thing, and it was very frustrating, and the doctor was afraid mm-hmm. because he didn't understand why the person was crying. He's like, have you ever had a dislocated knee and a broken femur before, then, you know, and he didn't, even though he was a doctor and he's fixed lots. He doesn't really, he's not been there and done that. So it's hard to have a little more sensitivity, but
can I say something on that real quick?
Yes, please.
This is so nerdy, you guys, that I hope you'll appreciate this. So I studied, this was last year. There were still just some aspects of anxiousness that just I wasn't able to grasp, that hasn't been taught to me, hadn't been taught to me, and I'm so glad. So this last year I focused a lot on anthropology, human anthropology, the study of our human species and our even, you know, more spread out ancestors of human species. So I studied in a little bit more neuroscience. So I studied the part of the brain that has to be engaged for empathetic thought. So if you look at empathetic thought, and that is just simply ability to grasp someone else's perspective that is different from your own. Mm-hmm. Here are some facts. Don't kill the messenger, y'all. and please, everyone, research this stuff. Knowledge is power. You can also go to Google Scholar. That's where you can access academic journal articles and such, rather than regular Google and mainstream. So the part of the brain that is actively engaged during empathetic thought. And so if you're looking at brain monitoring, the part that would light up, right, to simplify it, would be the gyrus area, and specifically the right supramarginal gyrus. And there are stats that show different groups of humans and who it engages more easily. Specifically, the female brain engages it a little bit more naturally than male brain, and there's some theories as to why. So that's one aspect. And then it could be social, conditional, different aspects of that. And then, but if that part of the brain, and that's a higher order thinking as well. So let's say someone's sleep deprived. Let's say someone is very doped up on a medication that manipulates natural chemicals, such as you have to feel an unpleasant chemical to feel guilt or compassion. That's like almost a sadness, right? Think of, so if there are a large group of people who don't, they're having chemical manipulation and or they're sleep deprived, that's going to reduce their engagement of that area of the brain. And then also you talked about, you know, with some people, it's a lot of TV, a lot of media, a lot of instant gratification, a lot of video games or technology. We get very annoyed and we want to kick the phone if it is too slow getting the Starbucks app up, you know. So we kind of short-circuited a lot of that anyway. So that all of those things kind of go along with lack of empathetic thought. There's a lot of research that has shown countries such as ours with increased wealth and comfort, there's a decrease over the last 5 years and then noticeably in the last 10 years. And we are one of the most egocentric cultures in the world. And again, it's just because of that comfort and the lack of need to engage the empathetic thought. That makes sense. So it's not that we're horrible people. It's just our way of thinking is a little different, and we need to be more directly affected to take up a cause.
Okay.
As an overall group, not individual.
I ran into a gentleman a long, long, long time ago that said that he was doing research on parts of the brain. Some family members are have genetically deposed to quick tempers, other than being able to learn to do that. And he found that parts of the brain can be when you're when they're children. If you want to, like, maybe influence more growth in the happy parts of the brain than the negative parts of the brain, you get involved in spinning and gymnastics and parts of the brain so you don't feed.
Physical
things like that to help them focus. And plus, it gives them a discipline. And I've always wondered, you know, if you have to do that for the rest of your life or, you know, once you're grown. I know the frontal part of your brain for boys is not totally developed until they're 23 or 24. And girls, they develop, you're 19 or 20. So, but still, it's still developing.
Exactly. That's critical thing. So there's, always neuroplasticity.
Exactly.
Yeah. And love it. And
well, how can you influence, if you're already grown, I'm so sorry. Yeah. If you're already grown, what kind of things, and, you know, hopefully people are open-minded that they can think about maybe trying things out. What kind of things can they do to influence happiness in their brain? I mean, other than meditation and things like that.
Oh, there's a wonderful movie on this, you guys. It's a documentary. It used to be free on Netflix. I'm not quite sure if it still is, but you can also download it online on their website. It's called Happy the Movie. And I watched this back in 2011 or 2012. It's amazing. It's a documentary on happiness, and it talks about exactly this. There is a genetic predisposition and a component, but I like to talk about, picture a pie chart. Mm-hmm. The brain is the only organ that physically adapts and changes due to external stimuli. It's not like your heart. It's not like your, so there is a genetic component, but that's vastly misunderstood. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean you're static. It just means there is, we are the DNA from our parents. So obviously there's a part of it, but all of that is changeable. So you picture a pie chart. A small piece of that pie chart, let's say not even 25%, I forget the exact percentage, is a genetic like this. But just like you said, if someone is, we've all been around babies, right? Mm-hmm. Some are, if you have twins and everything is exactly the same in that baby bed in that room, but one reacts a different way to being hungry. The other one's kind of cool being hungry. The other one's, But even that's kind of hard to differentiate. But so there is a piece of it, but that movie gets into those kind of thick components and the things that build happiness. And this is what the UPenn, so I encourage everybody to look that up too, University of Pennsylvania. These are the research gurus on positive psychology and resilience. Positive psychology is basically a perspective or an approach to psychology, and that's the angle that I use. But we don't need to study sickness, and we don't need to study horrible things and negativity to know how to create happiness. That makes no sense. We need to study who's happy and replicate those things. So this movie, Happy, the movie, it does that, and it looks at people where anything you logically think would make you miserable or sad, it doesn't. And that was my experience in, you know, very poor places around the world where I would do some of my work. And that's when I first noticed. It was in 2006 on a U.S. Navy ship, the USNS Comfort, and the people experienced in Haiti, they lived where they used the restroom and gutters, and they had, you know, these little boys that we helped, they had their intestines on the outside of their bodies their whole life, and goiters are very common, big, bulging masses. They were full of joy, and they were genuinely happier than many people I saw here, and that's what sparked my interest in happiness and positive psychology. Wow. So Happy the Movie follows people in areas like that where, you know, here's a rickshaw driver. How is he genuinely laughing and happy? Well, it's all relative, you guys. It really, really is. We have so many things here that, quote-unquote, make us happy. Things do not make you happy and joyful in a lasting way. It's only momentary. Mm-hmm. So we need to raise that balance in the scale as far as things that make us happy momentarily. We have that in vast numbers in the U.S., right? We have everything. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at my daughter's, you know, corner of the room with all her silly LOL dolls and My Little Ponies. It's kind of real. But I also take her outside several days a week, and we go on nature hikes, and I teach her, and I am creating her internal dialogue of what's really important in life, and she believes it, and hopefully she'll continue to. But Happy the Movie will help to understand what truly composes happiness. Positive psychology, anything from UPenn and resilience work, Dr. Martin Seligman, that's S-E-L-I-G-M-A-N, Dr. Martin Seligman, he has a TED Talk on positive psychology. He will talk to you very factually and scientifically about what creates and constitutes happiness. It's not la-di-da Pollyanna stuff, but the Scandinavians just have a very realistic view. The Danish book on parenting will help you to understand that. And that book was very influential for me in shifting some of my U.S. dialogue to be a little bit more Danish, and it was our roots in U.S. too. It's just not current. Yeah. So it's more like our grandparents would talk, very reality-based. You shouldn't go about your day expecting for everything to be perfect, and when it doesn't, then you are annoyed at what makes it imperfect. That's just not reality. Mm-hmm. But we're so blessed here with so many things that we kind of expect that. So in Denmark, they might say, you know, it's a stormy, horrible, cold winter day outside, and you're about to go home from work, and the storm has hit. That happens in the U.S., and I've been there. It's like, oh, my gosh, the roads are going to be horrible. Traffic's going to be awful. Never going to get home. It's going to be dangerous, right? That's what we say, mm-hmm. typically. Not mm-hmm. every human, of course. there, that would be very uncommon to hear that. Now, you would hear from someone, I'm sure. But in general, they're going to almost like skip over the fact that, yeah, they're just kind of accepting that that's a part of it. And they'd be more likely to say, oh, horrible storm out. Guess it'll be a good day to stay in with the kids for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
See what I mean?
Yeah.
They go to that next step. And I remember, I think back to my grandmother, she would talk the same way. She didn't lament and go on and on about this imperfection or how this is impeding upon her day. It was almost expected because she had lived through the Dust Bowl and the Depression and the rationing of World War II. So her brain kind of used to that and knows that this isn't so bad. So perspective is huge, and there are many people who they've lived blessed lives and they haven't had a whole lot of that perspective. We've had a little of it lately. How many times have you heard people say lately, oh, I'll never take this for granted again?
Yeah.
That would be perspective.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
This is really our only dose of it that we've had in a generation.
Yeah, and we don't know how
helpful
to act.
Yeah.
We're inconvenienced.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a total, total joy. I always try to remind people to be present in the moment. But that's another thing, is even if you are going through something uncomfortable, you have to look at the bright side, that maybe at that moment it'll make you feel something. I have had patients who told me they don't get upset with pain. And I said, but why? He says, because pain reminds me I'm still alive. And it's just like, whoa, that's a negative. So I hope my listeners, my manager has decided just to close the phone lines because we were all interested in what you had to say. Is there a way that people can contact you or follow you? Can you give out information where people can contact, or articles that you've written, or your Facebook or Twitter or anything like that?
Sure, and I do need to, I've been told I need to get more active on that. I love my life so much, and any spare moment I have.
You just have a practice and writing a book and raising a child. Yeah. What? You've got plenty of extra
time. I know. So, I'm not big on social media. I need to be, but I do have a Facebook page, a professional Facebook page, and that's my first name and last name, so it's Natasha with an O. I'm almost trying to help people to sound it out back then, Cold War days. So it's N-A-T-O-S-H-A, and then my middle initial K, and then my last name Monroe. But I have that professional Facebook page, and I put quotes up there and book links and stuff at times. And then I am in the DFW area. I'm a therapist. I have a small little boutique group of amazing therapists, and we love to help people in this area. So we're in DFW. And I encourage anyone, always shop for a therapist. If you go to one and you don't feel it, or you don't think they're listening to you, go to another one. Find the right fit for you. Psychology Today is a really great website, and you can put in find a therapist in your area. And there are a lot of people doing telehealth, so they just have to be licensed in the same state that you're in.
Do you do
so
telehealth?
That's an option for you. I do. I piloted the first, we didn't call it telehealth, but I was the first telehealth for the military in Afghanistan, and I've been a fan ever since. I was not before that. I was snobby, and I was like, oh, this helps people who can't get out of their home or don't wish to. So yeah, I do it now for a portion of my clients.
Okay, all right. And one more time for your Facebook, your name.
And then also, that's probably the best place. It's Natasha K. Monroe. It's N-A-T-O-S-H-A, so Natasha, and then the letter K, my middle initial, and the last name Monroe, M-O-N-R-O-E.
Okay. All right. I know your time is valuable. I appreciate you talking to us. Hopefully this
appreciate y'all so much.
Deflect some people and calm some people down and help them work on their internal turmoil before they do anything. But I always ask my guests, when you're having a really bad day and a bunch of things, negative things are happening, what's the one thing you can close your eyes and always think about that brings a smile to your face?
Oh, I love to picture my little girl's smile and laughter. That's what I do. Amazing.
And they grow up fast. I have a 14-year-old right now, and
even
though he's bigger than I am, I still remember when I used to carry him around.
So. Yep. Oh.
Well, blessings to you. Have a positive and relaxful day. And thank you. I will contact you in four to five months for an update. Is that okay? All right.
Well, perfectly fine. I love it.
Thank you to Dr. Natasha Monroe. Thank you. Thank you. And you have a very safe day.
You too. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Be blessed. Bye.